During meditation, do we count the breath or say in out or just be aware? Thank you. There are many different ways of doing this, and some people might be counting the breath, but counting it forward, counting it backwards. If you say in out, that's more like you are noting the breath. That's a bit like the Mahamsa Sayadaw tradition, where you note everything you do. If you look at the Anapanasati Sutta, we'll be looking at this. Why, maybe on Monday, probably the last day. So anyone's going to be left on Monday then? Some people will be doing that, yeah? Some people will be left by it like that. So we're going to go through the Anapanasati Sutra on Monday and look at the details for the description of the breath meditation. And the Buddha basically says, you know the breath, yeah? So it's by knowing the breath. You don't have to say anything, you don't have to count it. All that is really superfluous. The reason why people like to count and even note the breath is because it gives a little bit of force to what you're doing. Then if you count it, it's almost like you have to force your mind onto the breath. In one, two. Yeah. And to be able to do that, you have to use a bit of force on the breath. So it kind of gives, and that is both the advantage and the disadvantage. It is the advantage in the sense that it enables you to stay with the breath, but very often at the expense of not being able to relax 100%. Yeah? When there's force there, it's very hard to fully relax. That is kind of the negative side of that. So ideally, I would say, the best way to do this, if you really want to relax and enjoy it to the maximum, is to just, enjoy it, allow the mind to come into the present moment. Sometimes the mind may not even want to come into the present moment. Maybe you're just too tired, or too many things have been happening, and you can't do it. But in ordinary life, this will very ordinary, very commonly be the case. Yeah? You had a long day, you're trying to watch the breath at the end of the day, and there's no way that your mind is going to watch the breath. So what you do on those instances is just you use the meditation as a way of relaxation, or you use it to do a bit of, allow the mindfulness to come, or a bit of metta, or something like that instead. Use a guided meditation to help you out. That is often the best thing to do in daily life. Unless you have a daily life which is pretty relaxed, you have you're not very super busy, anything like that, then perhaps you will be able to watch the breath as well. So it depends. But watching the breath, it actually is not a very easy thing. And people think that it is the basic kind of meditation. Actually, it is not really basic at all. It takes you all the way to enlightenment if you're able to watch the breath properly. It's actually very profound. And a lot of the things that pass for breath meditation, I often think it is not really the real, quite the real thing. So, but try these various things. You can try to count, you can try to do these things and see what works for you. Make sure, the most important thing for me is always that you're enjoying what you're doing. That is what really matters. You're not going to enjoy every meditation, you're not going to enjoy every breath, but generally speaking, that you enjoy is actually so fundamental to this whole practice. Okay. Oftentimes when we are kind to others, and we are taken for granted in the worldly life, and when we spend time resting, doing nothing, and trying to meditate, our family starts to get rid of it. Shides are saying, we are laying around, bludging around, not doing anything. They expect us to keep doing, achieving, and working hard to earn more for the family. Having more money seems to be the goal in life. Otherwise, we will be looked down upon by others who are doing better than us. How to have peace in life. Okay, good question, isn't it? I really like this question. That's really being very honest, kind of straight to the point. That's great. First of all, the idea of being taken granted, being taken for granted by others because you're kind. Well, don't be kind of be kind in the right way. Don't be kind in a kind of in a stupid way. Yeah? Be kind, but if sometimes it is okay to express your opinion as well. It's okay to sometimes to be a little bit assertive. Doesn't mean that you are completely submissive. That's not what a Buddhist is supposed to be. Yeah? You can stand your ground a little bit. So. But even when you stand your ground, you do it with a degree of kindness rather than with anger and all of these kind of things. Please don't allow yourself to be taken for granted. That's certainly not the Buddhist way. So one way of doing that is precisely that, you know, not take it means that you would say, well, I need this personal space, yeah. And by claiming the right to have your personal time and your personal space to meditate, etc., you are asserting your right to do things your way. Then people will see, yes, you are kind, but you also have a mind of your own to do what is right in your own life. And then people will start to respect you. It's not that you're always giving in, always doing what other people think of you. Think of someone like Ajahn Brahm. I mean, he's very, you know, he knows what you do in life. He's not going to allow himself to be bullied around by others at all. There's no way. Yeah, he's got a very strong person. And he, you know, that's why he's able to do things like ordering bhikkhus, even if the whole world goes against it. He will do it if he thinks he's right. Yeah. The rest of the world goes one way, Ajahn Brahm goes the other way. Yeah. And this is a strength of personality. It's got nothing to do with not being kind or not. It's just that you do what you know is right in your life. So that is how not to be taken advantage of, yeah? Not to be taken for granted. You do what you think is right. But you do it with kindness most of the time. Yeah? Then I think you will be okay. Yeah? As far as you know, earning money and all of these things, well then, you know, after you have started to read the word of the Buddha, you start to understand what the Buddha is on about. You start to understand that this is not no path to happiness. You understand that there is a little bit of happiness in worldly success, a little bit, of course, otherwise people wouldn't be doing it at all. But it's really, it is in the long run, it's really unsatisfactory. So when you know that, you know what you have to do in your life to be able to have real success for yourself in a deeper sense. Yeah, and after a while, you become the example for everyone else in the family. Initially, they shine you. Initially, I think you're just a loser. Yeah, and Ajahn Brahm says, yeah, you're a loser, great. The greatest loser is kind of the best person for Ajahn Brahm. You lose as much as possible. And after a while, people get it. They actually, after one, they start to understand that you are actually right. Why? Because you are able to be more kind. You are able to be more peaceful. You are more together than they are, even though they are striving for money and BMWs and what have you. Yeah. And after one, they get it. That's exactly what happened to me. I was quite stubborn. Yeah? My family said, we have failed in the upbringing. I said, whatever is your position, I want to become a monk. My parents said yes, because that's, you know, if you really want to become a monk, you can't really say no, it doesn't make any sense. So they're okay, well, that's what you want to do. And, you know, we will say yes, we don't agree, but we will say yes anyway, because it's your decision what you want to do with your life. And then, of course, yeah, even though there was so negative in the beginning, all the time, it just changes. Gradually the wheels of samsara turn, and things are completely altered. And as I mentioned many times before, you know, this started off so negative, now it is so positive. Whenever I go back, you know, with my parents, I have something to talk about. I'm talking nonsense. I can talk about Dhamma. I can do some meditation with them. Yeah? I have a much richer, much more meaningful relationship with your family and your parents once you start getting involved in the spiritual life and the Dhamma life. And this is what's going to happen to you as well. Be a bit stubborn about it. If you know that this is right, don't give in and say, this is my practice. If you want to figure out why I'm doing this, listen to this talk. Yeah? Something like that, yeah? And this is okay, this is what I'm doing. Yeah? And it's okay to be a bit stubborn if you really feel something is right. It's not really being stubborn at all. It's just being assertive because you know what you have to do in life. And people, I can almost assure you, in most cases, if your family members are fairly reasonable, then they will gradually come around. And then, you know, you have a massive impact on the family, massive impact on the people around you. What a wonderful thing that is. Okay. Okay, how to arouse mindfulness when the mind is dull? It is not easy. Often the mind is dull, and it can be dull for a number of reasons. One thing is that it's just tired because there have been many things going on. And very often the best thing to arouse mindfulness is just to sit back and wait, so see what happens. And I mentioned before that I know some very good meditators who are dull every time pretty much they sit down to do meditation practice. And they start off by nodding for around 15 minutes. Yeah? So if you've nodded, you are in good company. Yeah? So please nod. Yeah? You are allowed to nod in this group, in this gathering. Yeah? So you nod, and then because the mind is just temporarily tired because too many things have been going on, I was sitting in the room behind you today, and I was hearing the Abhidhamma going on for about 4 hours. Yeah? I didn't really hear it clearly enough to understand anything, but I could hear the Abhidhamma going on. And I thought, Jesus, what is this kind of? This is dukkha. What is Abhidhamma stuff going on? Okay, so that is, it means you can't really, what are you going to do? I can't really do very much about it. So that's okay, that's just fine. But it makes people get more tired afterwards and have to listen to all the other Dhamma. And this is life. Life is often, sometimes like this. You can't control things. You just go with the flow. If you don't go with the flow, much, much worse. And then you feel a bit tired. You continue going with the flow when you feel tired. And then you just allow yourself to be tired. Sometimes the mindfulness will arise again after a while because the mind is rested. Sometimes it won't arise. And the reason it won't arise is often because your mind is not developed enough yet. People, for example, have a tendency to depression. If you have a tendency to depression, it's very hard to get not to be dull and to have a bright mind. Because depression taps the mind of energy. Depression by its very nature is a low energy state, yeah? So then you work on yourself to kind of increase the energy over time. Right? With right reflection, right attitude, all these kind of things, the energy will come back, will re-emerge. And then you are ready for the mindfulness. Everything will come to you. There's a short-term solution, which is just to chill, yeah? Just to know the victim wherever it is. And then the long-term solution, which is practice in the Dharma. Over a long period of time, over many years, and things will come together because of that. Okay. Well, it's four questions on one piece of paper. That's really unfair. It looks like not that many questions there, but then you have to multiply by four. Whoa, okay. One, how long is an eon? And what about the world cycles? How long is the eon? Pretty long, yeah? And I think the eon, as it may mention the sutta, I think it is quite likely to be equivalent to what we call a Big Bang cycle in the modern universe. I think it's quite likely to refer to that. So from one Big Bang to the next Big Bang, that's what I think an eon is. So how long is that? There are some symbols in the sutta. Now, which one is the? There are some of the symbols are really over the top. I don't think they actually are quite right. I think they are exaggerations. But one of the symbols of the eon is that if you have a rock, solid rock of granite, and it is 1 yojana cubed, yeah, yojana is like 15, 16 kilometers cubed, you come with a silken cloth. And you kind of swipe the one side of the rock with a silken cloth once every 100 years. And the eon, the rock will be completely gone before the eon is over. Yeah? It sounds like a top. It can't be that long. Yeah? If you start calculating, how many atoms do you take off every time you swipe that rock with a silken cloth? Not many. I think it sounds too much to me. Yeah? I don't really believe that same thing, to be honest. It's not because I don't have faith in the word of Buddha, but I somehow doubt that Buddha actually said that. But I think there are some other similes. What about the similes for the eon? Does anybody remember the similes for the eon in the suttas? Does anybody remember the similes for the eon? No. I can't remember. I think there are some other similes in there for the length of the eon. But I think it is easier to think of it from a modern astronomical point of view. Yeah? So far, since the Big Bang, it's about 13 billion years. So, and then how long to the next Big Bang? We don't know that. But, it gives you a rough idea how long it is. That's what I would reckon is more likely. And this is what I also call the world cycle. Eon and world cycle is not the same thing. What is the difference between a ghost and an angel? Well, the difference is one is much happier than the other one. Okay, that's one difference. So you can see the ghost and angel among humanity here. You see the kind of the dodgy characters sneaking around at night, they're kind of more like ghosts. Yeah, and you have the angels, the bright people, the happy people, they're more like the angels. So you get some idea just by looking at people, you already have a rough idea the difference between ghosts and angels. So basically, it does different karma, leading to different rebirth. Generally speaking, if you are a ghost, it's considered a lower realm. You go there because you've done bad karma usually. It's not terribly bad, it's even worse to be an animal. There ghosts are actually higher than animals. And often ghosts are beings that are attached to things in this world, that can't really let go properly, that can't move on to a proper new rebirth, they're kind of hanging in there, waiting for some other karma to take them further. So it is a kind of miserable rebirth. Often the way it is described, and this is often in later literature, like Kheta Vattu, Kheta Vattu is a little name like the stories of the Petas. Petas are ghosts. And very often they are described as being a lot of desire, like a big tummy, with lots of desire for food, yeah, whatever it is. But the mouth is very small, you can't eat much. So strong desire, but you can't really get your desire satisfied. Yeah? This is kind of the Kheta Vattu. That, of course, can be quite painful if you have to be like that. So that is the pain as well. If you are an angel, a deva, you are like a superhuman, yeah? You are like a human being with far more happiness, far less troubles, far less problems than you have as a human, but much more happiness. There are many different, many different levels, yeah? Many different degrees, depending on how good your karma is. But it's not really strange. Maybe you think that these things sound really weird. But actually, it's not very weird at all. If you get reborn as a deva, here you are. You are just a deva. This is you, just continuing with a different kind of body, with a different kind of experience. But there's nothing really weird about it, is there? Oops, I'm a deva now, okay? You'll carry on being a deva. And if you get reborn as a ghost, oh no, I'm a ghost now. Oh, this is bad news. Yeah? And you are a ghost. But it's almost just like you carrying on with different perceptions, different view of the world. It's not as if you suddenly become something very different. It's still you, your mind, your personality, moving on into that new existence. Where does a ghost stay while waiting for rebirth? In the ghost realm. Yeah. Ghosts hang out in the ghost realm. That's where ghosts stay. So where exactly is that? It's not a physical destination, it's a mental destination. It could be right here, yeah? And that's why people sometimes can see ghosts, because it is a mind, meeting mind in a sense. So it's basically right here, among us right now. It's not really, it's not a place, physical place, but it's a mental place, that's where it is.
Can you explain the hungry ghost era?
Yeah, the hungry ghost is one way of putting it, but it's not actually called that in the Pali, the kind of the realm of the ghosts, of what it's called there usually. Well, hungry is a kind of later addition that has kind of come with a later over time. Yes. So I mean, like, big belly with a small mouth, so over hungry. So that's why they're waiting. Sometimes the ghost realm is actually a rebirth in its own right, yeah? So you actually stay there for a long period of time. How to identify Arahant? Okay, so the best way is you become one yourself, and you can really identify it. Yeah? You know, yeah, I'm an Arahant. Do you know how to know if you're an Arahant or not? Sir? How do you know if you're an Arahant? Sir? Because you actually know it. If you're an Arahant, you know straight away. Rebirth has come to an end. You know that rebirth has come to an end. Yeah, that's what you know in Arahant. But how do you identify someone else who is an Arahant? And it is impossible to be absolutely certain whether anyone is an Arahant or whether anyone is anything at all. It's really hard to tell. And all you can do is have some idea of those people and are worthy of and respected, worthy of some degree of confidence, worthy of some degree of faith. That's really all we can ever do on the Buddhist path. So you look at people, and this is what the Buddha says we should do. He says you should look at them, and you should observe them, and you should see whether they have the qualities of an Arahant, whether they are devoid of anger and ill will, and whether they are devoid of greed and desire, whether they are devoid of delusion and confusion. Yeah? And if you see that, if you see someone who is devoid of those things, then you have the basis of putting some degree of faith into your confidence into that person. Yeah? But of course, it's not just a matter of being devoid of these things. If you don't have these bad qualities, you will have all the good qualities. So you will be kind, you will be generous, you will have metta, you will be have a degree of wisdom, you know, your mind will be very clear, you will have the ability to feel that in the presence of people like that. So you have to observe, and the Buddha said, not only do you observe in the short term, you observe in the long term. So you keep on observing to see what's happening. And you have to be wise yourself to be able to see the things. That's the downside, yeah. But if you're not wise, what are you going to do then? You have a serious problem. Most people aren't that wise, so they think, oh, Arahant's here, Arahant's there, you see Arahant's everywhere. But actually, if they haven't got enough wisdom, they deserve the difference. This is part of the problem. So actually, it gets quite difficult. But in the end, trust your own judgment. The only judgment you have is your own judgment. I have heard people say things like, I can't trust my own judgment. It's because I can't trust it. I will listen to what this person has to say. Now this is crazy. What are you talking about? Who decides to listen to that person? You decide that. So you're still using your own judgment. Yeah. In the end, you have to use your own judgment. There's absolutely no choice. So trust your judgment. Be humble about it. Be careful. Be circumspect. Look again and again over a long period of time. And then you start to see what is going on. And then you will have a good way of doing it. But don't go around parroting everybody else. Yeah, the whole world sees Arahants left, right, and center in it. Be a little bit skeptical about that. Stand back and say, maybe, I don't know, but let me observe for myself. That is the right approach. So look for those qualities that Arahants are supposed to have. And if you see them over the long term, then you can place a degree of confidence there. But even then, not absolute confidence. In the end, it is the Buddha that should be the final refuge, the Buddha Dhamma and the Sangha, and not individuals. So place your final confidence in the Buddha, his words, and the Sangha as a community. Yeah? Then you are on the right track. And then you won't be too disappointed. When sometimes monks, you think Arahants are this role. Arahants not only this role, yeah? Usually they just stay in the role. So not much point in this role when you're an Arahant. In fact, once you're an Arahant, you have given up Nirvana already. Yeah? This is one of the factors of Arahantship. You have given up the specter of householdership. That's in the Mahavachakota Sutta, I think it is. That's one of the Vachakota Sutta, Mahimakaya 73. Yeah? The specter of householdership has been abandoned. You can't be a householder anymore once you become an Arahant. Yeah? So there's no chance. When you see people on the internet who go to internet pages, it says on the top, Arahant, so and so, yeah? And then he talks about all the things he does, yeah? On Monday I go to work, and then I go back to my wife. You're not Arahant. But it says on the banner of Arahant, yeah, Arahant, Peter Smith, Arahant, or whatever it is. Crazy stuff. People are so conceited sometimes. Actually, it's astonishing how conceited people can be. And so be circumspect about these things. Okay. Then observe, I've been reading up on Pure Nan of late. My key takeaways. One, we may not be enlightened in this life. Two, it may be harder in future lives as we are living in the Dhamma ending age. Three, one is assured of enlightenment in the Amatara land. Right. Generally, Theravadan practitioners do not accept such doctrines. Okay, why don't we accept this? Because the Buddha didn't say it basically, yeah? This is just stuff that has been written over time, and stuff that is basically unreliable. That's why. You may wonder, where does it all come from if it is so unreliable? And remember, a lot of things in the world that arise as teachings and doctrine, a lot of things are unreliable. Even though people mean the very best, even though they're trying to pass on reliable information. It's just the nature of human beings that sometimes we are unreliable. Very often what happens is that people have some kind of insight or vision from the meditation. And based on that vision that they have in the meditation, they write the sutra of Yeti sutra. And they write a new sutra. They talk about, oh, God, tell me how about land, if you land and seeing this and that. They probably had that vision. They probably saw Buddha there, or they saw what they thought of Buddha there, and Bodhisattva. And then they write the book, and then everyone else believes it, and then they get, you know, let down the garden path, because it isn't true. So here is where you have to have some kind of a common sense about what is going on. This is why I say, place your confidence in the word of the Buddha. The word of the Buddha is where you find real Buddhism. The Buddha started all of this, but he talks about that is the foundation for everything else. Everything else is built upon what the Buddha was saying. If the Buddha was wrong, everything else falls apart like a house of cards. So we have to assume that the Buddha was wrong. So put your faith there, put your emphasis there, forget about all this other stuff. The Pure Land Sutras are sutras that came into existence maybe about 1,000 years after the Buddha. Yeah. Nobody knows exactly who wrote them. Some anonymous author. How can we really put faith in some anonymous author? We have no idea why they wrote this, on what basis, who they were, whether they were good natured or bad natured people. We have absolutely no idea. Why should we put our faith in that? It is really silly to put too much faith in these things. Even if we assume that they were well intentioned, trying to do their very best, still, delusion is always a very powerful driving force in the human mind. And for that reason, we can never trust these things. So, we may not be enlightened in this life. That is true. You may not, but you just do your very best to go as far as you possibly can on this path. Yeah? And if you do that, then you are practicing to the best of your ability. And just remind yourself that pure land is not an alternative, and that makes it more committed to practice in the path rather than looking for pies in the sky, which are illusions. So, going to take you down the garden path and actually lead to more suffering in the long run. Yeah, this kind of practice just leads to more suffering. It's just illusion. That's really what it is. I'm sorry, I'm speaking. I'm just saying what I think it is. Yeah, I'm just being very direct. I hope you don't mind. It may be harder in future lives as we are living in the Dhamma ending age. Well, again, this whole idea of the Dhamma ending age, the Kala Yoga, or whatever it's called, Kala Yoga, it's just, again, a later thing in Buddhism. It is not something. It's something that happens in Tibetan Buddhism, in certain types of Tibetan Buddhism. But the Buddha doesn't actually say that there is such a thing. Yes, it is true, the Dhamma does decline, and eventually the Dhamma will disappear, of course. And that is enough reason to make sure that we practice hard, because we never know when it's going to happen. But to say with precision that we are already in that age, and sometimes even in Theravada, it's even worse. Theravada countries are going to say, oh, it's impossible to become an Arahant these days. You can't become an Arahant, and we're a three-mentor anymore. So Buddhism is finished. Now what we have to do is just make sure that we born in the time of Maitreya. Yeah, that's what they're saying. Let's get this crazy idea. Absolutely silly. You don't know anything about Maitreya. Maitreya is not a pie in the sky. You don't know anything about him. Will there be another Buddha? Sure, there will be another Buddha, because Buddhas are just natural phenomena at the rise of the world at regular intervals. There will be him, but we don't know anything about him or her or whatever. We don't know when this person will arise. We don't know if we will be able to recognize them if they arise. Yeah. Maybe when you see Maitreya, you think, oh yeah, who's that fool? Yeah, we go and take a different path. Yeah, just like you see in the sutras. Many people just didn't really understand what the Buddha was about. Are you sure that you are wise enough to understand the Maitreya when the Maitreya comes around? Maybe not, yeah. So Maitreya comes. You've been waiting, and now he comes and you walk the wrong path. Yeah, it's terrible, but this is how it is sometimes. So for that reason, now is the opportunity. And the Buddha kind of makes this point again and again. Now is the chance. Take the path as far as you possibly can. And then you are doing what is right and what is appropriate. You are assured of enlightenment in Amitabha Land. Sure you are assured of enlightenment. Amitabha Land, I don't know if you have read these sutras. What are they called again? These sutras, they talk about Amitabha, Sukha, Vyakti, Sukha, what are they called? Oh, I can't remember now. Anyway, it doesn't. When you read those suttas, there are realms of sensuality. And there are realms where there's kind of beautiful music around all the time, and everything is just perfect. Yeah, they are completely missing the point of what enlightenment is about. There are sensual realms, and sensuality is something you have to abandon on the way to enlightenment. It's not kind of, if you indulge in enough sensuality, you'll become enlightened. That's almost what the suttas are saying here. So I think it is really completely the wrong frontier. And if you place your head plate of that, I'm afraid you are, I think, heading completely in the wrong direction, unfortunately. Anyway, that's my point. That's just my point of view. So, there you are. Okay, next one. Here I am. Is it true that you were a rock musician before you were named? That was Anasujato. You confused me with someone else. Anasujato was a rock musician before I left. I was not a rock musician before I left. Maybe I was in the past life, not in this life. But Anasujato, he was a guitarist. He played guitar in a rock band. The rock band was called Martha's Vineyard. I think if you Google that, you can still kind of hear some of his songs. Maybe you can see him on YouTube or something. Yeah? And he had long hair, and he looked really fearsome, I think, in those days. Anyway, okay. Dear Adam, what is a jhana? Is it important to know about before you watch out for it? Okay. What is a jhana? Jhana is the state of samadhi. What we were talking about the other day, about the this sutta that was called the Volition Sutta, whereby you gradually go through the various stages, you become more and more happiness, the piti, the prasanti, the calm, yeah? And as you become more and more peaceful, you have become more and more intense happiness in your mind, more and more powerful happiness, you are converging gradually onto the jhana space. There comes a point when the bliss and the peace are so powerful, you drop into a kind of a new realm, and that is when you drop into the state of jhana, and then you are kind of locked in there for a certain time. And it's a state of intense pleasure, and it's a state of where there's no defilements of the mind. It's a state of absolute solidity. That's why people think it's God, yeah, because there is no movement anymore, only one thing. The whole universe is unified. Yeah, this is why people talk about universal consciousness and these kind of things. And so it's a very, very powerful state. And then after that, that's why you have the great opportunity to insight after these things. So is it important to know that you watch out for it? Just take your meditation gradually. And if you ever get close to these things, that is a good opportunity to ask. Yeah? As a more skilled meditator than yourself, ask what is happening, what to do next. The purpose of having a teacher in meditation is just to help you guide you roughly in the right way then. So you know where you're getting, you know whether you're heading in the right direction. What do I do now, yeah? Always people come and say, oh, I'm getting excited, I'm getting a little bit, my meditation's going well then. So the teacher's job is like, don't get excited, you're not getting that far yet, so just chill, just relax, yeah? Just enjoy what you have. Then. And when you just enjoy what you have, and you focus on the practice, rather than expect the result, that's when they come. Well, people get a bit fearful because the sense of self is starting to disappear. And you can feel the clinging to the sense of self is holding you back from going deeper in your meditation. Yeah? That's why you get fearful, because parts of you are disappearing. That's why the experience of samadhi is a powerful non-self reflection, powerful non-self experience. Number two, what food and drinks can or cannot be eaten after noon for an 8th precept holder? Okay. It's the standard thing is what is called in the sutta. We have something called the five kinds of medicines. They're called medicines. I'm not sure medicine is a very kind of good translation. Tonics are sometimes called, the little kind of things that pick you up a little bit if you're feeling a bit tired or whatever. And according to the Vinaya, this is actually the monastic rules, but they are kind of taken over also into the 8 precepts. And these things that you can eat are oil, yeah, it's sugar, Hanena. And then there's something called Navanitang, and then there's ghee. Yeah, there's other fine things. Navanitang is, nobody knows exactly what it is, but it's something like cheese, butter, something like that. So that's why we often add cheese in the, especially in the forest tradition in Thailand, is usually considered the lab. Whether it really is the lab or not is kind of a slightly gray area. Some people say no, some people say yes, but it's a small thing here. So that is roughly kind of the area where what is allowed. That's why chocolate is allowed, because chocolate consists of oils, yeah, fats, sugar, and then you have cocoa. And cocoa is another kind of medicine. It's called a lifetime medicine, because it is just like a bean, yeah, like pepper or cocoa or whatever it is. And these are used medicinal beans, rather than actually edible beans. If it's an ordinary green bean that you eat for dinner, it's not allowable, but these kind of are considered medicinal beans because they are used for drinks and that sort of stuff. Tea, coffee, chocolate, all of these kind of things are allowable. So it's pretty flexible. It doesn't have to be too strict, yeah? If you want to take milk in the afternoon, and also I would say it's probably okay, yeah? Because it's a slightly grey area. Soy milk is generally considered acceptable. It's made from beans, considered acceptable because they give an allowance in the India. If you are ill, you can take broth. Yeah, so it's a bit like broth. So even meat broth would be considered allowable, especially if you are ill. So it's quite broad. There's quite a few things that are acceptable in there. Don't need to be super strict. Yeah, if you are an preceptor, have a certain rule, because otherwise it just kind of goes too far, but be reasonably flexible within those rules. Can a priest of use deodorant? Oh, now that is. I think that is. There are different types of deodorant that are not very strongly perfumed. Yeah, so you can use something with less perfume, perhaps. Because sometimes if you use a lot of perfume, it can kind of, especially if you go on a retreat and somebody uses perfume, it kind of throws on people in the pants a little bit. But again, it's not a big deal, yeah? It's just a kind of small thing if you use a deodorant, perfumed or unperfumed. I think it's either way, it's kind of, yeah, it's not such a big deal. But if you use a lot of perfume and aftershave and things, you kind of smell like this kind of a, you know, this perfume factory, then it's not so good. So tone it down a bit at least. Okay. Dear Anjan, is the end goal of Buddhism self-annihilation in transcending the cycle of rebirth? I know that there is no permanent entity to be annihilated, but what happens at the end? Say a robot unplugs itself and has its components removed. It doesn't exist anymore after that. Are we like that robot? Okay, so what happens in the end? And the end goal of Buddhism. This is the problem. Yeah? You say, I know that there is no permanent entity to be annihilated, but. Yeah, this is kind of the thing. The but there kind of gives away the whole thing. Because the reason why you say that is because it feels like you're going to be annihilated. Yeah. And this is precisely the problem. You know, technically speaking, from the Buddhist, the way the Buddha is explained in the suttas, you know that you're not supposed to be annihilated because there's nothing to annihilate. But the but problem is precisely the problem because it still feels like that for us. So it's very hard to really grasp fully what the end of the end of samsara, or the end of the existence of cycle of rebirth, what it really means, precisely because we will misunderstand. It's impossible not to misunderstand unless you are a stream actor. So I wouldn't really, if I were you, I wouldn't think about it in those terms at all, because it actually is misleading. If you try to think about it in those terms, you're going to be misled, because it is impossible to really understand it from that point of view. Much better to think of this nirvana, the end of the cycle of rebirth, and happiness. This is the highest happiness. It's the end of suffering. And who does not want the highest happiness? Especially if the alternative is endless suffering, going round and round, going here and there, and kind of just despairing at all the problems in life. You may think we have many problems in this life, but it's nothing compared to what you have in samsaric existence. So think about it in those terms. Then it makes sense. Yes, end of suffering, high happiness. Yes, I can understand that. Everybody can understand. At least you have some idea what's going on. But if you look at it from the ending of rebirth, what actually means that it's much more difficult to understand it. So stick to what you can understand, and then see what happens in your meditation. See what happens as you approach the goal. See what happens when your meditation gets deeper. What does it feel like when your meditation goes deeper? And you realize, actually, it feels incredibly nice. It feels so peaceful. It feels so wonderful and beautiful. I want more of this. And what is happening there as a meditative leader, there's less and less of you present as you go deeper and deeper in your meditation. Yeah? And it's time to be able to extrapolate what the ending of all existence is about. But don't try to understand what is all virtually impossible to understand. This is why the Buddha said to Vajragupta, the worker, he said, when he asked precisely this question, what happens after the Arahant dies? The Buddha said nothing. Yeah? Why? Because he knew he would misunderstand it. Yeah? Okay. So stick to that and then see what happens and gradually move towards that point. And then one day you will understand these things. So one of the problems in Buddhism, when you look at the way Buddhism is taught around the world, there is a lot of eternalism in Buddhism. There's a lot of people who say that, you know, the mind will keep on existing forever after the Arahant dies. And that is, to me, just classic eternalism. The mind will go on for the ever after, exactly what the Buddha says will not happen. Yeah? So there is a lot of eternalism. Be very careful to be trapped by eternalism. Instead, just keep an open mind and see where this path leads you. That is often the better approach. Because otherwise you might get stuck in some sort of the wrong view, essentially. The robot unplugs itself and has its components removed. It does not exist anymore after that. Are we like that robot? Well, the robot didn't have any suffering to begin with, yeah? So the robot is kind of whatever, exist or not exist, not an issue. Yeah. Did you know about the little machine Adam Brahm has? Adam Brahm had this idea that it's a kind of a robot, and it's a machine that turns itself off. You know that one, yeah? It's pretty cool. So we had to have it in the monastery down in Perth. And there's this box, and there's a lid on the box. There's a switch that you flick, you flick the switch. And when you flick the switch, the lid goes up. This arm comes out of the box, goes down to the switch, turns the switch off, and then the arm goes back in the box and the lid goes down. It's a machine that turns itself off, yeah? That's exactly what we're talking about here. And it's really kind of cool. And Adam Brahm said, this is the precise metaphor for Nirvana. This is exactly what Nirvana is. You turn the self off, yeah? And then you experience it. And that is the high happiness. Anyway. So there you are. Okay, here I am. While I enjoy the session so far, why do I feel more relaxed than I am while doing nothing here, i.e. between sessions? You compare, actually sitting down with eyes closed and legs crossed. The reason is because you're trying too hard, yeah? You're not able to relax properly. This is basically the reason. You're sitting down and you think, I'm meditating now. And that thought that you're meditating means that you are kind of already tensing up a little bit. Don't meditate. Instead of thinking of it as meditation, think of it as relaxing time, yeah? Whoa. Wow, so nice. So peaceful, yeah? Relaxing. Enjoying it. It's all about learning to enjoy it. This is what I mean, this is why learning to enjoy meditation is so important. Yeah. And this is exactly what happens between the session, because then you don't meditate, yeah, you're just relaxing. Yeah. So change your attitude. The attitude is, I'm going to relax, I'm just going to enjoy, I'm not going to call it meditation anymore. That's exactly what I'm not going to do. Don't do anything, nothing to do with the breath, nothing to do with trying anything. Just chill and sit back and enjoy it. Yeah. And then we're kind of learning to let go. Because it's all about learning to let go. And actually, it's strange, yeah? How hard people often find it just to let go, just to allow things to be, and just to enjoy life in this way. Yeah? And sometimes you will find, you know, in your daily life, you go back home and you just sit down, and suddenly you feel really relaxed. And that is the kind of state you want for your meditation, yeah? But it's precisely when you do nothing that these things happen sometimes. And that is what we try to approach also in the meditation practice. So. But it's a tricky thing, yeah? And this is kind of why we have to we need to de-emphasize all the striving, de-emphasize the counting the breath, de-emphasize all that kind of stuff, because that buys into this thing that you actually can't relax properly. Diamante, you are somewhat famous right now, I can tell you. Presumably you are treated well almost wherever you go. Yeah, you are treated quite well, it's true. Not always, there are some people shout at you. I remember I live in Australia, the Australians can be a bit rough sometimes. They shout at you and say, you, Hare Krishna, I wouldn't have a clue what they're talking about, but that's kind of irrelevant. How do you resist the deal with the temptation of sensual pleasures? Eating good food, people treating you nicely, etc. What can lay followers like us learn? A lot of the people treating you nicely is just, you know, that's very nice. It's always very nice to be treated nicely, but there's always, as I said, when you live in the Western world, people always, there is a limit to how nice people are going to treat you. When you come to Asia, some of the people treat you as if you're a king or something, maybe not so much here, but I mean, in Thailand especially, yeah? You put on a pedestal, and it's as if everybody thinks you're an arahant, and they treat you like, drive you around in Mercedes and put you up, and it's kind of crazy sometimes how they treat monks, especially Thailand is probably one of the worst places. And it is not healthy, but in the West, it doesn't happen like that. In the West, people are much more, there's a more sense of equality. Thailand, very kind of a hierarchical society. If you're a monk, you're the top, yeah? And you can say anything. You can give the most hopeless Dhamma talk. And people say, Sadhu, Sadhu, Sadhu. That's wonderful when we will serve. And this is how it is so easy. In the West, you have to earn your respect much more. And that's a good thing, yeah? It's good that you have to earn your respect, because it means that you take the monastic life a bit more seriously and you try a bit harder in that. So it's a positive thing. So I don't think that dealing with people treating me nicely, I don't think it is a big problem. Yeah, as a Brahma will always kind of bring you down to earth again. If you start to become a bit kind of too uppity or whatever, you're going to say, okay, he is very good at that kind of thing. You never really get a chance to get too much of an ego and things around at a Brahma, which is great. Too much nice food? Yeah, but you know, there's a limit. You know, you can't eat in the afternoon, there's kind of clear limits with it. So I don't think it's not a big problem. The big problem is, if you come down to meditate and all you think about is food in your meditation practice, that is when it is a problem. I never think about food in my meditation. Never. It's just absolutely out of the question. It doesn't even occur to me to think about that. So I don't think it is a major problem. So it is a fairly small thing. So I don't think there have been any problems with those things. What can lay followers like us learn about these things? Well, one of the important things for monastics is that, you know, one of the things is not to be alone with opposite gender. It's actually quite useful when, you know, somebody would have an interview in there, and when Bobby sits in there, well, it's actually quite nice, because it takes away any of that intimacy between two people. That is often the most dangerous area for a monastic. Because especially maybe if your monastic life isn't going so well, the vacation isn't getting together, and you start to look for happiness in other places. That's where people end up disrobing. And this is really, in the end, in the early days as a monk, you disrobe perhaps because you are confused or you have a wrong view, you don't understand what Buddhism is about. But the more senior you are, in the end, the only real reason why people disrobe in the end is basically because the monastic life isn't going so well and they look for happiness somewhere else, in a relationship or something like that. That is really the biggest problem. But it's not up to, you know, in the end, it's not up to the lay people to kind of to sort that out, because really it is the responsibility of the Sangha to make sure that they live appropriately and in the right way, even with these kind of things. So, as lay people, the main thing that you have to do is to Yes, if you see things kind of going a bit funny, a bit wrong way, then it's kind of good to maybe bring it up with them if you ask what's happening. But generally speaking, support both Mahasiswara, good Mahasiswara, and Nansa, and whatever. And then that is really the best, I think, the most appropriate thing to do as members. Okay. Seeing Adaramali Ephesia explain the sutta is a great blessing. So powerful. Sadhu times three. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, that's wonderful. I'm very glad that you enjoyed it, because I always get inspired myself by reading out the sutta. I think they're so powerful and often so simple. It's not that hard to understand. Yeah. The main message often very simple and very kind of direct and understandable, very practical, yeah, very kind of down to earth. This is what I love about these sutras. So I'm very glad that you are getting some of that inspiration yourself, because that is precisely what I'm hoping to convey. I may not always succeed, but that is my kind of my aim anyway. Dear Bhante, please advise 1. How to remove judgmental habits. 2. Why people judge like the best hobby, especially Buddhist. Thank you. Okay. So how to remove the habit of being judgmental of other people? And again, it's very similar to many of the things that I've been talking about already. Remember that people are the way they are because they have been programmed this way. It's a deep program laid down in a life, probably a very long time ago. They have no choice. Yeah, they are the way they are because of that program. And when somebody doesn't have a choice, how can you judge them? Can't judge them anymore. If you judge them badly, you kind of, if it was their choice, you can judge them badly and say that they are bad. But if they just are nature, if they're just kind of the natural things coming out of them, you can't really judge them anymore. It's like judging a red light. Yeah, you can't be judgmental of the red light when you come to the red light. When you come to the red light, you accept it. You don't say evil red light, bad red light, yeah? You don't say that. It doesn't make any sense. You don't get out of car and start shaking the red light, because then you might be locked up in an asylum afterwards if you do that. So, but people are like red lights, and that's kind of the point. People are like red lights. People sometimes do stupid things because the cause and conditions make them do the bad things. Yeah, and after a while, just stop judging them. Remember, if you judge others, you're also going to judge yourself as well. Yeah, and this is part of the problem. You cannot just judge others, you cannot judge yourself. And sometimes you will do stupid things. And because you have judged others for doing that same stupid thing, you will get really depressed about yourself when you end up doing it as well. So it'll have really bad repercussions for yourself as well. So if you can have compassion for others, and understand, with kindness and care, why they are the way they are, you can also have that kindness and care for yourself, because you realize that actually it's very hard to deal with these habits. It's very difficult to be different. One of the ways that I always, people often want to change other people. You are married, you want to change your husband or wife. It shouldn't be like this, it shouldn't be like that. You want to change them. But remember, every time you want to change somebody else, whatever it is, remember how difficult it is to change yourself. Yeah. And once you realize how difficult it is to change yourself, what right do we have to depart changing other people? We can't. We have to accept other people as they are. That's the only rational way of doing things. So learning how to accept is difficult, yeah, because it means that we have to lower our expectations. We have to lower our views sometimes of other people, what they can do and what they can't do. But sometimes the miracle happens. Once you lower your expectations a little bit, and you stop demanding the change, that is sometimes when the change actually happens. Because as long as we demand change for somebody else, they will often be defensive. Yeah, they will say, you don't have the right to demand this of me, why are you putting pressure on me? We become defensive. Once you stop demanding, the other person doesn't become defensive anymore, there's nothing to defend. And once they are no longer defensive, it's easy for that person to look at themselves rationally and see their own shortcomings by themselves. So actually, by not demanding it, sometimes the change comes about. Sometimes it doesn't, yeah? You just don't know that. But sometimes it does. So it's always better not to judge and just to allow people to be the way they are. Remember conditioning. very profound, very deep thing. It goes back a long way into the past. And this is why it is so scary also at the same time. So why do Buddhists judge it like the best hobby? And because Buddhists are people. Yeah, people judge it. People are silly. People do silly things. And Buddhists judge just like everyone else. And that means they can still improve their Buddhist practice. There's a potential to improve if they are still judging it. So, and sometimes people are Buddhists, but they are not very profound Buddhists. They are Buddhists on a surface level, rather in a profound sense. And they haven't really understood the Buddhist teachings fully. I think that sometimes it's interesting, seeing this Abhidhamma class going on here today for almost 4 hours. I thought, gee, it's a long time. And you wonder, and I often think that, you can learn all this Abhidhamma stuff, but it often ends up becoming just intellectual knowledge at the back of your mind. You have learned something, but like going to university and you learn things. But how practical is it? And I'm willing to bet, I didn't go to that Abhidhamma class, but usually Abhidhamma classes are not very practical at all. And you come out at the end and you don't know anything about how to live your life well. Yeah, you haven't really learned anything about that. You have learned something about the number of chittas, 89 chittas, 28 manifestations of rupa, you know how to classify them, you know how they bind together and how they work. You've studied the Abhidhamma, the Sangha, the compendium of the Abhidhamma. And I have read these things, I know roughly what's in there, and it is not practical. And this is the problem with Buddhists. We tend to be Buddhists who do rituals. We are Buddhists who learn impractical stuff. Instead of going, getting to the core, this is a path, this is a practice. This is something that we should be doing with our lives. That is when the Buddhist teachings have power. Yeah, often we talk about, we feel a sense of regret, we see that many Buddhists are becoming Christians or whatever. But that's okay. It doesn't matter if Buddhists become Christians, because most of them are kind of Buddhists in name only anyway. And that's no point in being Buddhist in name only. Buddhism only works if you practice it. So even if 90% of Buddhists become Christians or Muslims or atheists or agnostics or whatever, no worries. As long as those who remain practice properly, that is what really matters. So we should kind of, the aim should be to get Buddhist people to actually take the teaching more seriously. Because that is when they become powerful, that's when they become useful. And if we can do that, then we are doing a good job out of this. Last question for tonight. Why did the Buddha touch the earth? I saw this statue in the shrine hall downstairs. Yeah, this is the Samadhi Mudra up here, but that's a different one. This is the Samadhi where it sits like this. So in the shrine hall downstairs, they're called mudras. Mudras means like different postures with the hands, yeah? So you have like this posture, it's like a fearlessness posture. So it's like, the Dhamma is meant to protect you. You have this one, which is like generosity, yeah? Giving out. You have this one, which goes like this, setting in wheel the motion of the Dhamma. Yeah, you have Samadhi. And then you have, as you said, the touching the earth, but it's on the knee and touching the earth, And the idea behind that is that, and this is not early Buddhist, this is not actually, written in the scriptures anywhere, this is just a later kind of idea. The idea is that when the Buddha awakened, there was no one to evidence his awakening. There was nobody around, nobody could actually, prove the fact that he had reached awakening. So he says, I take the earth to be my witness. The only witness he could have was the earth, and he touches the earth. So it's very symbolical. Obviously, the earth can't really be a witness because the earth is just the earth. But it's a symbolical thing to say that, there is no other witness around it, so I take the earth to be my witness. In other words, basically, the Buddha is his own witness for his awakening. That is the symbolism behind that. But the whole idea of Buddha statues only arose a long time after the Buddha. In the very early days, they used other symbols to symbolize the Buddha. So if you go to some of the most ancient stupas in India, to the Barut stupa or Sanchi stupa, or you go to Bodh Gaya and those places, and you see the symbolism is often like an empty seat, or you have the Bodhi tree, and these symbolize awakening, but without the presence of the Buddha. The statues of the Buddha started out maybe the first century BC or something like that, and then gradually they evolved from that. So a statue of the Buddha has nothing to do with the likeness of the Buddha. We have no idea what the Buddha looked like, but that doesn't really matter. The purpose to me of a good Buddha statue is to express some of the qualities of the Buddha. Yeah? To me, a good Buddha statue is a statue when you see it, you feel at peace, you feel relaxed, you feel kind. It brings out the same qualities in you because they are reflected in the Buddha statue. I remember coming into a home in Singapore. I was in Singapore in late December. I was living in the house of this incredibly wealthy man, just ridiculously wealthy. And you come into his house, and straight away coming into the house, there is this Buddha statue right there in the opening as you walk through the door, yeah? A very beautiful, ancient, antique Buddha statue, because he could basically buy whatever he wanted. And it was very beautiful, and it gave the house a very powerful and beautiful feeling, because you had a beautiful Buddha statue right there in the entranceway, right? It comes in, and you get this feeling, this is a real Buddhist household. And that is a kind of, to me, a nice way of using the Buddha statue. You create a really nice atmosphere in the house in that way. That atmosphere, of course, then helps you as well to live better, to be more kind, because the atmosphere is right. That is what a Buddha statue should be about. Okay, so that is all for tonight. And as usual, I wish you all a good night, have a nice rest, and then we'll see you back here again tomorrow morning. And before we end up, let's just pay respect to Guru Namah Sangha.
Sipati Mando.